Now, if you've spent any real time on social media, you've probably figured out that it offers some good stuff and some bad stuff. And for some people, maybe more bad than good. A string of high-profile celebrities have recently said they've had enough and are taking a break. A few examples. Back in January, Pamela Anderson said she posted on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook for the last time. In February, Elon Musk said he was staying off Twitter for a while. Last month, Alec Baldwin deactivated his Twitter account, said it wasn't worth the harshness. Last week, Megan Thee Stallion announced she's entered, quote, a period of regeneration, said that her managers will run her social media accounts. Our next guest says sometimes you got to do that for the sake of your mental health. At the very least, come up with some healthier social media habits. Mark Ostash is a digital wellness expert, lifestyle coach, and author of the book Courage to Connect, Stories That Encourage Meaningful Connection in Your Life. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thanks so much for having me to the show.
Well, I know you're not anti-social media in and of itself. You've got some accounts, the Facebooks, Twitters, and Instagrams. Before we get into, you know, the warning signs that we might be doing too much with them, what benefits do you see from connecting via social media?
You know, social media can be a huge blessing and can be a big curse, right? It just all depends on your perspective. It keeps us connected, as you know, to loved ones. And you can see those old high school friends from decades back. Or you can keep a pulse on even family members that you might not have a chance to reach out to during the daily kind of activities. So in those ways, social media does give you a pulse on people that you normally wouldn't have a chance to connect with.
Now let's get to the curse side of things. When can we start to realize that we're having a problem with social media and it can sneak up on us?
Right. Well, you know, I like to start people by rooting them in this idea that the digital calories you consume need to be viewed the same way you look at your physical calories. So if you feel like you've had pizza three nights in a row and you're feeling bloated and like you're losing motivation to exercise, there's a similar effect that can happen when you're digitally bloated. You've read too many news headlines that have polarized you in nature. You've checked email right before bed. You feel digitally kind of constipated sometimes, or indigestion of the content that you've viewed or consumed. And my view is just to say, hey, how do we become a little bit more mindful of a little bit more of a balanced palate, a balanced plate to the types of content that we're consuming?
Yeah. What is a checklist for us to become more mindful of when and how much we're consuming our social media?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. One of the things I'd like to encourage people is when you find yourself saying, today on Facebook I read, or today on Instagram I saw, and those are the bulk of the comments or conversation starters in which you're sharing, I would challenge you that it's time to think for yourself a little bit in that given day. So that's one indication. The other thing is if you know that you're feeling a little bit more doom and gloom, or you might be more susceptible to eating those greasy calories, if you will, online on the racy headlines or on the kind of the aimless scrolling. That's another indication that you might need to shift your focus from a digital activity to an analog activity like walking, exercising, or even just literally picking up a book.
I've heard from a couple of people now. I want to hear what you think of this, Mark. The idea that if all we're doing is consuming, just scroll, we're not going to get much out of it. The people who actually get happier from social media are ones who engage in positive ways. They comment positively on that family picture from that cousin they haven't seen in a while, or they post something similar to that. What do you think of that idea?
Yeah, it's a great perspective, and I do agree with it. I think in the book Courage to Connect that I just launched last year, I do just that. I share people, or I give people ways that they can connect both online and offline. So as you just mentioned, some of us just like to scroll. We are viewers, kind of consumers of the goods. And we might not feel as confident in our ability to share or comment or to create content. Well, truth be told, when you have an opportunity to kind of support somebody with encouragement, or even just a small text after seeing a social media post where you can tell that they might need some additional support, that goes a long way in ways in which you have kind of the courage to connect with those around you via social media, text, email, or even, God forbid, we pick up the phone and call somebody. but there's definitely a balance. And I believe that if you can take at least one proactive connection of your day, even if it's in that tertiary kind of friend, end quotes, that you've seen on social media, and reach out to that person in a more meaningful way, it'll help balance the digital calories that you're consuming.
We're talking about the toll social media can take on our mental health and how to improve our well-being with Mark Ostash. He's a digital wellness expert and author of the book Courage to Connect, Stories that Encourage Meaningful Connection in Your Life. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever hit a social media wall where you just had to get away for a while? What's a while? An hour? A week? A month? Have you figured out ways to connect smarter on social media and to feel like you're getting something positive out of it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can use social media that way too. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're talking about the benefits of getting away from social media and how to tell when it's time to take a break. A few high-profile celebrities lately have announced that they've had enough, at least for now, and that the negatives outweigh the positives. Mark Ostash stays with us, digital wellness expert, author of the book Courage to Connect, Stories that Encourage Meaningful Connection in Your Life. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. If you've had an experience needing to break away from social media, you or someone close to you, have you found positive ways to use it? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Mark, I saw you quoted, I think this is in USA Today, about a particular time of using social media, and that's bedtime. Why should we be careful when we're about to go to sleep?
Well, it's really important to what I like to call land the plane. So if those of you that have been flying, maybe it hasn't been recently, but you don't just land the plane from 30,000 feet up and just drop right down to the runway. You have to ease in and descend into the runway to get a safe, smooth landing. Same goes for your bedtime routine. If you're just plugged into email or social media and you're in bed and you just think you can set your phone down and gracefully get into bed and fall asleep, you're probably going to have nightmares or have trouble getting to sleep. So again, going back to that kind of approach to the runway, brush your teeth, move around, do some stretches, journal, reflect on the day. You even just lay in bed and look at the ceiling and count sheep, right? Like they used to do. Whatever it is, try to get away from the digital nature of things and into the more analog, reflective space. And that'll help you ease the plane of your mind into bed, get a more restful night's sleep, and prevent you from what I like to call suffering from post-traumatic scroll disorder.
And you just mentioned things we can do at bedtime instead of social media. Can you talk about maybe the benefits for time to do other stuff if we cut back from, I don't know, a half hour or 3 hours or whatever people are doing or just sort of mindless scrolling? What can we do instead with our time?
Yeah, Rob, you know, I was reading your bio and I saw that you have some interesting hobbies, both with music and nature. Yes. And just kind of hanging out. And it's like, imagine the amount of times you hear your people around you say, "Oh, I wish I had more time to learn guitar," or "I wish I had more time to finish that book that I've been working on." It's like, well, if you take a half an hour of your social media scrolling and you compound that over the week, you've just found yourself an extra 4 or 5 hours. You look at that on the year, you've, you know, just discovered hundreds of hours at your disposal that you can be, you know, replaced or displaced to new things like hobbies, habits, or, you know, even relationships you want to repair.
Now, you used that food metaphor earlier, Mark, and I think that's pretty interesting because when I think of, you know, people doing crash diets, they change things abruptly for a while, but we know that people will swing back and forth from diet to bad habits. I imagine there's a similar thing with social media. Instead of maybe like the celebrities are doing, going cold turkey, is it more about trying to figure out a way to build good habits into our everyday lives?
Yeah, it is. For those of you that have tried doing things cold turkey, it's tough. I have to laugh. I think about there is this Hollywood 72-hour diet that you could buy at like the local convenience store. And it was just like a liquid pineapple juice that had no nutritional value. It was a bit gimmicky. But I think about the celebrities that have recently quit social media. I wonder if they've actually been successful at kind of their declaration. And one way to be successful, whether you're a celebrity or whether you're just a local Wisconsin person listening to the call, is find something to replace your new found time with. And in psychology, it's a term called replacement therapy. So you need to make sure that you have an activity to replace the activity in which you are trying to cut back on. So again, whether it's learning how to cook or you know, exercising more or picking up that guitar and taking classes, that will replace the habit of social media scrolling.
I know sometimes people have that fear of missing out. You know that the social media world is moving on, and if you're not there, it's moving on without you. How do we break that compulsive fear?
Well, the fear is a physiological reaction of cortisol and other stress hormones that are racing through you. So you need to realize that your devices and the notifications and our dependency on them is a physiological dependency that we've created in this relationship that we have with our phones. So to that end, being mindful of when you're feeling FOMO, your breath is your best resource to calm the state of fear your body feels and to be a little bit more rational in the what if possibilities that your mind's conjuring up are most likely not going to happen. And it's your breath that's going to get you there.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. William is with us in Wakefield, Michigan. William, hi.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much. Great topic. My mother had a house fire there on Super Bowl Sunday and I had no insurance. So I started a spot fund page called Resurrect. And it found out that expressing yourself sometimes in a time of a crisis is a sense of relief to get it out. But then also, when you're on social media, if you're kind of encountering kind of negative feedback or different things, that you can just disconnect and turn your device off and go for a walk or, do something in nature or, you don't have to be kind of stuck in a situation that isn't putting you in a positive state of mind when you're going through a crisis.
William, thank you so much for sharing that story. I hope things worked out after that house fire. But William says, hey, there's this tool. We could bring people together in a tough time. But also, in a tough time, you don't have to sit there and take the bad stuff along with it, Mark.
Yeah, and William, just to extend on what I heard you say is that, there is a – we just have at our – regardless of your race, religion, your background, there's a need for human connection. And right now, during this hybrid kind of virtual world we've been living in via the pandemic, we find our connection in places like social media. So there is goodness that's found in there. It goes back to being mindful of when you feel like you're doom scrolling, just kind of scrolling to digest those empty, greasy calories, as opposed to if you are in need of connection and you vulnerably put yourself out there saying, I've had a bad day or I had a house fire or I have a crisis, and then you receive the support. That's a great way that you can use social media to help get you through tough times. So thanks for sharing, William.
William, thanks a lot for that call. Mark, I think a lot of people are going to be looking to reconnect now after some barriers in place from the pandemic. Can you leave us with a bit of advice?
Well, I like to hug. So if I saw you in person, I'd give you a hug. I don't know if that's going to fly with everyone when they're reconnecting in person, but your eyes are the gateway to your soul. So make sure that when you see those people in your next reunion or your hybrid get together, you use those eyes to both acknowledge and extend the appreciation you have for that person and keep your phone in your pocket. So that would be one piece of advice. And the next thing is push yourself to get back out there. There's been a lot of people articulating that they have almost an amplified sense of social anxiety because of the lack of social interaction they've had. My challenge to you is social connection is vital to human existence. Get back out there, be safe, do what you got to do, but start by showing your face, showing those eyes, and getting some fresh air.
Mark, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Mark Ostash is a digital wellness expert and author of the book Courage to Connect, Stories That Encourage Meaningful Connection in Your Life. We talked to him about how to have a healthy balance with social media and when it's time to take a break. Coming up, our guest makes the case that we need to dig deep to end long-term racism in the United States that built up over centuries. We'll meet the author of Radical Empathy, Finding a Path to Bridging Racial Divides. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Structural racism has impacted the lives of black people in the United States since before there was a United States. Though America has made some progress toward racial justice and equality, our next guest says the problems still remain deeply rooted. But she says individual people can make a difference if we open ourselves to the experiences and pain of others and understand our own stories and biases to move past the divide. It's a process she calls radical empathy. Terry Givens is a political scientist and the founder of Brighter Higher Ed. She'll be teaching at McGill University in Montreal and working as an academic lead and advisor tackling anti-Black racism. Her new book is called Radical Empathy, Finding a Path to Bridging Racial Divides. Terry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Can you start us off with the concept that's at the heart of your book? What do you mean by radical empathy?
So this started from a position of trying to understand empathy and how it could help us to understand other people and their experiences. But I realized we've been talking compassion and empathy and all these things for a long time. And I realized what we needed is that next step. And that next step is radical empathy. And so I'll walk you real quick through what I consider to be the six steps to radical empathy. Mm-hmm. So the first step is a willingness to be vulnerable. And I model that throughout the book. I am really vulnerable. I talk about my life experiences in great detail. And the second is to become grounded in who you are. And that was such an important step for me because I really had to get grounded in my identity, but also how I've been impacted by structural racism throughout my life. And then the third step is opening yourself to the experiences of others so that we can understand how others are experiencing not just structural racism, but just life in general. Fourth is practicing empathy, but the most important part of radical empathy is the last two steps, taking action. And number six is creating change and building trust. And that's what we really need today in this country, is to create change and to build trust.
Part of what you're hoping happens, Terry, is that people will share their stories and relate to each other as individuals. And to that end, as you say, you're vulnerable in your book. You share a lot of your own experiences and a lot of your late father's as well. Can you, we could spend hours sharing your story, I think, but can
yes.
you talk about some of the things that really led you to this book from your own life history?
Well, you know, the first thing that really, this is what I start the book with, is the passing of my father. He died suddenly from a heart attack at the age of 72. And I, of course, being at the time, I was a researcher, a political scientist, and I started doing some research into why, you know, people have heart attacks. And one of the main risk factors was just being a Black male. And I was like, wow, just being a Black male can make you more likely to have a heart attack. And it didn't matter what your income level was or your education. And so that kind of started me down this path. But then I also started doing more genealogy, understanding my family history, and even learning more about my father's history. And so, you know, that early chapter, I talk about his experience in the military and how, you know, there's a picture of him with his, you know, non-commissioned officer school class, and he's the only Black man. And I was like, wait a second, I need to have some empathy for my father and, you know, what the experiences he had. Because, you know, I was always wondering, why did my parent, I grew up in Spokane, Washington, and it's a very, you know, less than 1% Black when I grew up. And I said, why did my parents choose to have us grow up there? And once I started looking at my father's experiences and, you know, his need to assimilate and, you know, particularly being in the military, I had so much more empathy and compassion for his experiences.
I'm looking at that exact picture you just mentioned, and it makes me think, and it made you think, you write in the book, what was it like for him to be the only Black person in this room? This is soon after the Air Force is desegregated. He's one of the first Black people to do this. And this is something that I think a lot of Black people have encountered. Wait a minute, I'm the only Black person in this college class, whatever. The list goes on and on. Can you talk about that experience and the kind of stress that can come along with that?
Well, you know, there's so many different ways that stress affects us. You know, I think, you know, for my father, you know, it put a lot of stress on him because, you know, he's one of the first Black men to be, you know, in this desegregated military and to go to, you know, become a non-commissioned officer. And so he was bearing the weight of, you know, all the other Black men who would come after him and women. And, you know, he had to prove that he was good enough. And, you know, he always told me, both my parents always told me, you have to be twice as good to get half as far. And so I just imagine how hard he had to work and to, you know, and he this was in Shreveport, Louisiana, which is, you know, at the time in this is 1962. You can imagine a lot of racism going on. And I'm sure he experienced that in the military. He didn't talk about it, but, you know, it was something that was definitely there. And so he just, I mean, the stress and strain of him just having to every day face racism, but also show that he was good enough to be in that position. I can understand it because I've had that experience myself as a leader in higher education. You know, I'm always the first Black woman to be first Black woman to get, tenure at University of Texas at Austin, and to get promoted to full professor and to be a vice provost. I can go throughout my career. And, I was always that first Black woman.
Talking to Terry Givens about her new book, Radical Empathy, Finding a Path to Bridging Racial Divides. And I think, Terry, when people start to think about race or even think about the concept of having a conversation about race, bridges aren't the first thing that spring up. It tends to be walls. There's defensive reactions, and we focus in on the conflict. And that's there. We can't pretend it's not there. But can you talk about how we could turn those walls into bridges?
Well, the interesting thing is that's why I call it about bridging divides, because, I realized that I needed to practice empathy myself, because not only because of the friction that can happen between Black and white people, but between people of the same race. We often have ideas, my parents had this idea that if we became assimilated, we'd be, and they were right to a certain extent, that we would have an easier time in the workplace and so on. But they also did the next step, which was kind of cut us off from other Black people growing up in Spokane. And so I felt this disconnect. And so I had to bridge that divide. I had to realize, I have to be, I can't wait for people to come to me. I have to go to them and be willing to be open and understanding their experiences and relate my experience in a way that allows them to understand me. And, I have to do this a lot in the world that I live in higher ed and so on, where I have to help people understand my experiences. And then in doing that, hoping that they can better understand me. But also, in order to do that, I have to understand where they're coming from. And so it's very much a two-way street. And, I'm going to have a discussion tomorrow if anybody's on Clubhouse. I'm going to be talking about how we kind of bridge these divides in order to take action, but also from a political perspective, how do we bridge those divides? Because that's obviously high on the agenda right now.
I've read some people pushing back on the idea, and you talk about the concept of emotional labor, where somebody might say, well, as if they're Black, say, as a Black person, why is it my job to sort of guide and shepherd people through the conversation about racism? How do you think about that?
Well, my hope is that people understand. First of all, we all have to understand that we're doing this work. And, so what I say to other African-Americans, particularly women, because for some reason we seem to often be at the forefront of all of this, is that we have to take care of ourselves first. So so you have to find a balance. So for me personally, I feel, I'm a leader in my community and in higher ed. And so I put myself out there, but I also take time, I put my family first. I always make sure I have time for family. And I put myself first. I take, make sure I'm taking care of myself in terms of exercise and so on and so forth. So it's finding a balance. I mean, I want, so much of our, of or so many of us are already doing this work from the, whether it's as activism, but, even just taking care of your family. And that's something, I want to emphasize around my parents, because they weren't activists per se. They weren't out there marching. To a certain extent, I think they felt a little uncomfortable with what was going on with Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. But they were doing the work in terms of raising a family, having, my father building a business after he left the military. I'm the youngest of seven. They have seven kids who are now out there and successful in the world. And that's what they had to do. Not everybody has to be out marching in the streets or educating white people. Sometimes being an activist means just taking care of yourself and making sure your family is successful. But we all still have to understand that we live in a situation of structural racism, because we have to understand how those hurdles are impacting us and be able to work around them and try to tear down those hurdles.
And Terry, I think for white people in particular, the conversation about racism is kind of an on-off switch. Either somebody's full-on racist, or, as the phrase goes, not a racist bone in their body. Can you talk about where probably a lot of people are in between somewhere?
Right. And what I tell people is that we all, and I know a lot of people don't like the term white supremacy, but I'm going to use it anyway, because it's real. White is the norm in our society, and you have to come from that perspective. And when we understand that, we all live in the sea of white supremacy. So my neighbors here in Menlo Park, California, are not racist, but we all live in the sea of white supremacy. So that means that what's normal in my neighborhood is that it's very much majority white, and I can go across the 101 freeway and it's majority minority, you know, Hispanic and Black and so on. And we have to understand how those divisions were created. It wasn't because these people over here aren't worthy or, you know, don't have the education. You know, there's all these things that have been created. And I love the book. There's two books I really want to recommend along with my own, which is The Color of Law and The Sum of Us. And those two books really get at how structural racism has impacted every single one of us. And that's, if we come from that perspective and not just assume it's not just because I'm not racist, it's because we have these structures in place that perpetuate our divisions.
In just our last few moments, Terry, it's been a rough year in many ways, including in issues of race in the United States. Do you see signs that we're having more productive conversations, at least starting to?
Absolutely. You know, it's really interesting because it started last summer when we had these very much mixed race protests, right? It wasn't just Black people marching or just white people marching. It was us marching together. And I even experienced that here in my little neighborhood in Menlo Park, where there's at least 500 people who came out and marched along the street. And, it was a, predominantly white group, but we were creating a bridge with East Palo Alto and other majority minority neighborhoods and saying we are going to, work together to try and bridge these to get divides. And so I think we are at a moment where people are, these books like mine are flying off the shelves. People are reading, trying to understand, and people are hungry for this kind of connection.
We'll leave it there, Terry. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Terry Givens is a political scientist. We've been talking about her new book, Radical Empathy, Finding a Path to Bridging Racial Divides. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear a big case on gun laws later this year. We'll talk about what's at stake and what the case could mean for how we apply the Second Amendment.